From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Today, the prospects for a constitutional crisis in the presidential election. Atlantic staff writer Barton Gellman says if Donald Trump claims mail-in votes are fraudulent and contests the results, Republican legislatures might try to ignore their state's popular votes and send Trump representatives to the Electoral College. His latest article is The Election That Could Break America. Also, we talk with filmmaker Kirsten Johnson about her documentary Dick Johnson is Dead. It's a loving tribute to her dad, who's actually still alive, but dealing with dementia. In the film, she engages him in playful enactments of imaginary accidental deaths. She says it helps her cope with his inevitable departure. And Kevin Whitehead reviews the first album from an all-star band of jazz women called Artemis.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Hammacher Schlemmer, helping define modern living for 172 years. They were the first to offer revolutionary items that became common household necessities, such as the pop-up toaster. Today, their lineup includes an air purifier that uses natural convection to draw airborne impurities into its ceramic heating chamber and then releases clean air into the room. Find this and other items at Hammacher.com. Use code NPR20 to receive $20 off your order.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. If you're following the presidential campaign, you know that this is an election season unlike any in our lifetimes. Our guest, Atlantic staff writer Barton Gellman, says the 2020 vote might bring more than just turbulence and controversy. He writes that the coronavirus pandemic, a reckless incumbent, a deluge of mail-in ballots, a vandalized postal service, a resurgent effort to suppress votes, and a trainload of lawsuits are bearing down on the nation's creaky electoral machinery. In an article in the Atlantic's November issue, Gellman examines scenarios in which contested counts in battleground states might embolden state legislatures to set aside their state's popular votes and select their own partisan representatives to the Electoral College. That would trigger a constitutional crisis that the country's laws are ill-equipped to resolve clearly and peacefully. Barton Gellman has spent decades as a journalist covering foreign and military affairs, national security, and other subjects. He won the 2014 Pulitzer Prize for Public Service for his coverage of the National Security Agency and Edward Snowden. His most recent book is Dark Mirror, Edward Snowden and the American Surveillance State. He spoke to me on Wednesday from his apartment in New York about his article in The Atlantic, The Election That Could Break America. Bart Gellman, welcome back to Fresh Air. Good to have you.
Great to be back.
You've been reporting for so many years on the Middle East, on foreign policy, in recent years on national security and domestic surveillance. What prompted you now to focus on the election process?
I started looking at the statements that the president had made about the election and about his intentions during the election, his confidence in the system. And it finally occurred to me that this was a man who was not prepared to concede defeat if it came, under any circumstances. And I decided to pull on that thread and see what the implications are for our electoral system if you have a candidate, and in particular an incumbent, who refuses to concede. And it turns out that that decision alone, that determination alone, has cascading effects on the system.
Right. Well, of course, the president, when asked, has declined to state that he will respect the outcome of a vote that doesn't go his way. He's done that a lot. You say that he will never concede under any circumstance. How can you be so sure?
I take some pains in the article to try to explain why I'm so sure, because I think it's such an important foundation for the piece. But take a look at what the president has said, first of all. He's been offered the opportunity multiple times in the last campaign and in this one to express his willingness to lose. That's really what it comes down to. Are you prepared for the possibility that the people will vote you out? And he has always declined to say that. And he's gone further than that. It's not a maybe. He said in a little stunt in the 2016 election that he was fully prepared and was offering a guarantee here and now to the American people that he would accept the results of this great election if I win, he said. He has, this time, not only in informal remarks, but in his formal written acceptance speech for the Republican nomination on August 24th, the president said the only way that we could lose is if the election is rigged. The American people don't get a say in this as far as Trump's sort of frame of reference has it. It's either going to be vote for him or the vote was crooked. That's a man who won't leave. There are many aspects of his past behavior and frankly his pathology that lead me to think this is an immutable decision on his part.
Now, you make the point in this piece that the willingness of the losing candidate to concede defeat in a presidential election is more than an exercise in civility. And you point to the conclusion of the Bush-Gore recount dispute that went on for weeks in 2000. Explain your point here.
The thing is that concessions by the defeated candidate are how we end elections. That's the moment when the contest ends. There is not an all-powerful umpire who gets to blow the whistle and say, the score is final now, boys. You win, you lose, get over it. We don't have that in our system. The system presumes good behavior and presumes that a rational and well-meaning candidate will accept reality when it comes. Some people would think, well, that's not true. The Supreme Court ended the 2000 election, and it did end the recount in Florida in 2000. But there were still 6 days left before the Electoral College met, and Al Gore had constitutional options to continue the fight even after the Supreme Court ended the recount, and he did not. The day after the Supreme Court decision on December 13th, 2000, that was the day that the race ended, because that's the day that Al Gore came out and said, I accept the finality of this decision, and for the good of the country, for the unity of the country, I recognize George Bush as our president-elect. That is a crucial, critical moment, the recognition. It's actually, as the political scientist would say, constitutive of the authority of the new president that his defeated opponent sort of bends the knee.
Right. So you could have a situation where if there are contested outcomes in several battleground states, you know, you could have multiple lawsuits in state courts that are appealed to federal courts, and that can take a long time. And putting an end to it with both parties recognizing an outcome is the simplest way to shut it down. Otherwise, it could really go on, right?
Right. Well, it can go on in court, and it can go on otherwise. We're used to disputes of a certain kind in this country going to the courts, but it's an unnatural act for an unelected judge to be the decider on the outcome of an election. They can judge procedure, they can judge whether someone is following the rules in the count, they can judge whether the conduct of the election comports with election law and the Constitution. But deciding the count is beyond the court. And there are other forums of decision that become more important as time goes on. If Trump can run out the clock, if he can keep the count in doubt, even if a county or state election official says, we've got the count, it's this many for Biden and this many for Trump, if he keeps that in controversy long enough, then the states are going to start to run into time pressure to appoint their electors to the Electoral College, which meets on December 14th.
You say that a lot of people, including Joe Biden, have misconceived the nature of the threat posed by Donald Trump refusing to concede. What's the misconception? What's the deeper threat?
It's a subtle difference, but an important one. The usual way people say it is that they fear that Trump will refuse to leave the White House if he loses. He'll refuse to give up the reins of power. And Joe Biden says, well, that's an easy one. If he loses and he stays there, someone will evict him. That will most likely be the Secret Service or the military. They'll say, excuse me, sir, but your lease has expired on this office. It's 12:01 on January 20th, and we're going to now assist you in departing. That works if there is a clear winner or loser. The greater danger is that Trump is capable, using the powers of the presidency and the powers of his invincible decision not to concede, to raise doubt whether a winner or loser has yet been established, that he can prevent the achievement of a decisive outcome which is a far greater risk to the American system.
So, speaking in the broadest terms, what's the scenario that might lead to an election result that ignores or discounts the popular vote in key battleground states?
We are accustomed to the idea that we choose a president by the popular vote in each state. That is to say, if I'm in Pennsylvania and the majority of my fellow Pennsylvanians vote for Joe Biden or Donald Trump, then that's the person who gets the electoral votes, the 20 electoral votes that represent Pennsylvania in the Electoral College. And the first one, the 270 electoral votes, wins the election. The thing is, nothing in the Constitution says that there has to be a popular vote at all. The Constitution says that each state legislature may decide in the manner of its own choosing how the state's electors will be appointed. And Donald Trump's campaign has noticed that, is aware of it, and is talking about the possibility that if the electoral count is still in dispute, if Pennsylvania is called for Biden, but Trump continues to insist that the vote count is fraudulent, that it's marred by fraud, that it's been rigged and is not legitimate, then the Trump campaign could ask its Republican allies in the state legislature to take back their power under the Constitution to directly appoint electors for Trump. So they would set aside the popular count by asserting that it was hopelessly poisoned by fraud, and they would simply appoint Trump electors. If that happened, then the Democratic governor of Pennsylvania would be likely to certify the actual popular vote and send a slate of Biden electors to the Electoral College. And so on December 14th, there would be two groups of 20 men and women, each casting the same electoral votes in opposite directions. And it would then be up to Congress to decide on January 6th, during the formal count, which votes counted. And that's not going to be an easy process.
Have we ever had a circumstance or where states did just what you described, decide that either we don't trust the popular vote or it's in dispute or there are questions about its integrity, so we're just going to decide as legislators? When, if ever, has that happened?
It came very, very close to happening most recently in the year 2000 during the Bush v. Gore recount, when the Republican Florida legislature passed resolutions out of committee in both houses to simply appoint Republican electors while the litigation was underway about a recount, while the fight was still being fought in court. The Republican legislature said, well, we're not going to stand by and wait for this. And they passed out of committee resolutions that would have appointed Bush electors directly. They were going to vote on the floor of both houses, and it was going to pass based on the precount. They were going to pass it on December 13th, but that's the day that Al Gore came out and conceded defeat. So it came very close in 2000. The only time I know of that it did happen is in the 1876 election, when four states had controversies about who their electors were. Samuel Tilden, the Democrat, had won the popular vote. Rutherford Hayes won the disputes in a special tribunal that Congress invented for the purpose to decide which electors would count. Hayes won those disputes, and so he was named president by this tribunal, which has only existed once in history. Tilden did not accept the result. The Democrats stalled for time, and 2 days before Inauguration Day, which that year was in March, 2 days, the dispute was still alive. Both sides were planning on inaugurating their candidate 2 days later as president. And it was only a last-minute concession by Tilden in arrangement for a kind of a repugnant deal that ended the Reconstruction. And under the threat of martial law being declared by his predecessor, by the incumbent, Ulysses Grant, only 2 days before did Tilden concede, and the country came very, very close to a terrible outcome.
But it's fair to say there's been no case in modern times where a state legislature has denied the popular vote. I mean, I think there is a commonly understood norm that for the Electoral College, the person that voters decide who that state's electors go to, it would be a major departure for a state to do that, fair to say, right?
Oh, very much so. It's more than a norm. I haven't checked every state law, but I imagine in every state there is a law passed by the legislature which states that electors shall be chosen by popular vote of the people of the state. And it would be legally questionable whether the state legislatures could take back their constitutional power to appoint electors after the vote had already taken place. And it would only happen, I think, in circumstances when the legislature was prepared to say that the vote could not actually be counted, that the count had been spoiled, and it was up to the legislature to reflect the people's will. That would be the argument made by the Trump camp.
Barton Gellman is a staff writer for The Atlantic. His article, The Election That Could Break America, is in the November issue of the magazine and is available online at theatlantic.com. We'll hear more of our conversation after a break, and Kevin Whitehead will review the first album from Artemis, an all-star, all-women band of jazz musicians. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air Weekend.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc. Teladoc gives those dealing with stress, anxiety, personal or family issues access to licensed therapists by phone or video. Teladoc is committed to quality, confidential therapy from the comfort of your home, available 7 days a week, matching members to therapists, counselors, and psychiatrists. Therapy is available through most insurance or employers. Download the app or visit teladoc.com/freshair today to get started.
We're speaking with Atlantic staff writer Barton Gellman. He's written a story considering the prospects for a contested presidential election this year in which some state legislatures decide to ignore disputed popular votes in their states and send their own partisan delegations to the Electoral College. His article appears in the November issue of the magazine. It's called The Election That Could Break America. So there is this provision that states could decide to ignore the popular vote and choose their own electors on a partisan basis. And that would presume a big, big problem with the electoral vote. And I think the scenario that's being considered now is problems arising from widespread use of mail-in ballots. Now, the president has been attacking widespread mail-in ballots, claiming they invite fraud. No real evidence, I think, among most election experts that there is any widespread fraud in mail-in balloting. Why is this a target of the president?
I would say it a little more strongly than you just did. I would say that nobody, despite many, many claims and many, many demands for evidence in lawsuits, nobody has introduced any evidence whatsoever of meaningful fraud in mail-in ballots or any other kind of ballots in American history. The voter fraud is a pretext that is used by Republicans for decades now to try to suppress votes of their political opponents. The leading Supreme Court case having to do with voter fraud had a unanimous finding by all the justices that in the state of Indiana, which was the state under issue at that point, there had never in the history of the state been any example of voter fraud. And the best scholarly estimates are that there may have been 31 votes cast out of 1 billion in the elections between 2000 and 2014. So 31 out of 1 billion votes may have been fraudulent. It's not a thing that happens. It has been invented out of whole cloth by the president.
Well, I have to say, I mean, there was the congressional election in North Carolina where I believe several hundred absentee ballots were regarded as fraudulent, right? It's not in the tens of thousands, but it does happen in some cases in small numbers, right?
There was an illegal collection of votes, which is slightly different. One candidate employed someone who was illegally gathering together and collecting mail votes. It's true that there are vanishingly rare cases in which someone attempts fraud, and there has never been a case when, even if the fraud had not been caught, that it would have changed the results of the election. So there is not a legitimate threat to election integrity from fraud. It is something that has been made up by Trump and particularly attached to the idea of mail-in ballots, which ironically are probably slightly more secure because there are more verification methods used in most states to confirm the eligibility of the voter and the integrity of the vote for mail ballots than there are in-person ballots. You have signature requirements, in some cases witness requirements, affidavits, and so on. The president has simply asserted out of whole cloth that mail ballots are going to lead to widespread fraud. He is doing that because he knows that mail ballots take longer to count. And his strategy is to say on election day that the count on election night is the final count, that we need to know the result on election night, that if he's leading in a state on election night and then the count starts to change as additional votes are counted in a phenomenon known as the blue shift, then that's illegitimate. That means that someone is trying to forge or steal or fraudulently add ballots, that votes for his opponent are quote unquote coming out of nowhere and should not be counted. And he's going to seek to stop the count on election night.
Right. And I think the point that mail-in ballots tend to be disproportionately Democratic and are likely to be even more disproportionately Democratic in this election is an important part of the president's thinking, isn't it?
Well, the president actually has shaped that. It is true that for about 20 years now, the so-called overtime count, which is the count of the late reporting precincts, the provisional ballots, and the mail-in or absentee ballots, that overtime count has shifted towards Democrats for reasons that are not entirely explained by the literature, but they're technical ones I could get into if you wanted. Trump has accentuated that this year by signaling to Republicans that he's against mail-in ballots and that they're corrupt, and by signaling to Republicans as well that the COVID pandemic is not as serious as the scientists say it is. And so Democrats, concerned about their health, are intending to use mail ballots at much higher rates than Republicans are, because Republicans have been pushed away deliberately by Trump from the mail-in ballots, so that now a mail-in ballot by proxy is likelier to be a Democratic ballot because of underlying circumstances and because of Trump's shaping of the electorate. And so his lawyers will know that if they are stopping the count of mail ballots, they are on balance almost certainly helping the president.
You say in the piece, and I think it's self-evident, that we need to change the laws. I mean, a simple solution would be to make the winner of the national popular vote the president. But in any case, that's not going to happen now or before the election or before this gets sorted out. Short of that, you say that there are things that we should all do to prepare for this. Maybe walk through some of that stuff.
Sure. So there are two piles of things to do to consider. One is marked later, real reforms that could keep us from getting into this sort of mess, as you mentioned. So you would certainly want to clear up the murky parts of the Electoral Count Act so you know whose votes actually govern if there are disputed votes in the Electoral College. You'd like to fund election administrators so that they could operate their counting process securely and more efficiently and more quickly on election day. You'd want to allow mail-in ballots to be opened and processed before election night. Ideally, we would get a close approximation of the final result on the first day. That's not going to happen this time. And so I think because the mail-in ballots are going to be so much the subject of litigation, I've changed my own mind personally on how I'm going to vote. I'm going to vote in person because I think the worst case is that the president is ahead on election night and that a fuller count of the vote over coming days and weeks shows that Biden wins. That's a very bad case because you have the possibility of weeks of serious disturbance in between. I think anyone who can volunteer to be a poll worker should do so. I think if you know anyone who is open to reason, you should make sure they know that it's normal and natural and lawful and proper for the count to continue to change after election night, and that it's sure to do so this time. But we have to make sure that the vote is counted, that all the votes are counted, and that the election is decided by the voters and not by some other machinations.
Barton Gellman, thank you so much for speaking with us again.
Thank you for having me.
Barton Gellman is a staff writer for The Atlantic. His article, The Election That Could Break America, is in the November issue of the magazine and is available online at theatlantic.com. A few years ago, pianist Reenie Rosnes organized an all-star band of jazz women called Artemis. In 2017, they did a European tour and played the Newport Jazz Festival. Their first album is now out. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says it's strong.
That's from Big Top by pianist Reenie Rosnes, ringleader of the international intergenerational women's band Artemis. It's from their CD of the same name. Supergroups combining far-flung music stars don't always work with competing sensibilities in play, but the members of this band are in alignment. Mutual support is built into the way the colorful horns may play scored passages behind solos. And one soloist may dive in while another is still finishing up, so the action is non-stop. Reenie Rosnes and trumpeter Ingrid Jensen, the band Artemis's two Canadians, on Alison Miller's Goddess of the Hunt. The backbone of any lively band is its rhythm section. Rosnes's piano and Miller's drums link in with Noriko Ueda's plump-sounding bass. Artemis's Israeli-Chilean reed section is Anat Cohen on clarinets and Melissa Aldana on tenor saxophone. All six players write or arrange for the band. Aldana's composition, Frida, for artist Frida Kahlo, uses one of the signature sounds of 21st century jazz, piano and bass playing in tricky, precise lockstep. Then Aldana layers on blended horns, which sound typically lush. One episode gives rise to the next in short order. The music keeps moving and the textures change. The sextet Artemis sometimes adds the dynamic singer Cecile McLaurin-Salvant an imposing presence on her own records. She's a less flamboyant team player on two appearances here, on Stevie Wonder's ballad If It's Magic and the obscure Maxine Sullivan vehicle Cry, Buttercup, Cry.
So dry your tears and maybe some tomorrow, but true love will happen your way. For life is a funny thing, joy, sorrow, it'll rain. So have no regrets and just learn to forget how to cry, little buttercup, cry.
The best oldie here is Lee Morgan's Boogaloo, The Sidewinder, given a revamp. The 1963 original smacked of manly swagger. Rini Rosnes's arrangement slows and calms it down, cueing up a friendly round robin for the three horns with Anat Cohen on bass clarinet. Ingrid Jensen on Harman muted trumpet really shines here. Pianist Rini Rosnes says these seven musicians realized the band Artemis had a future the first time they toured in 2017. They didn't just sound good, they also got along on the road, enjoying each other's company. That is just how Artemis sounds on their debut album. These jazz stars are cooperative, not competitive.
Kevin Whitehead is the author of the new book, Play the Way You Feel, The Essential Guide to Jazz Stories on Film. He reviewed the new album, Artemis, by the all-star band of jazz women, also called Artemis. Coming up, we hear from documentary filmmaker Kirsten Johnson about her new documentary, Dick Johnson is Dead. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
There are these networks of staunchly pro-gun groups on Facebook. And one of them is run by these three brothers, the Door Brothers. But it turns out, they don't just do guns. The Door family name has been attached to other causes.
Their goal is to eliminate public education and to replace it with Christian schooling.
The Roots of the Door Family on the No Compromise podcast from NPR.
Radio Ambulante is NPR's only Spanish language podcast. Listen for stories you won't hear anywhere else, told by the voices that make Latin America come alive. Each week, we bring you another remarkable story that will surprise and move you. Radio Ambulante, new episodes every Tuesday. Listen and subscribe.
Today, we're going to listen to an interview our producer, Sam Brigger, recorded with documentary filmmaker Kirsten Johnson. I'll let Sam introduce it.
Our guest, Kirsten Johnson, has a new documentary coming out on Netflix at the end of the week. It's called Dick Johnson is Dead. Dick Johnson is her dad, and while he's not dead, he's 88. The movie is about how they are both coming to terms with his dementia and with his inevitable death, and it's also a loving tribute to her dad's life. In order to help process his death, Johnson stages various accidents where her father dies, like getting hit in the head by a falling air conditioner unit, tripping on a crack in the sidewalk, or falling down the stairs. And her dad acts out his demise in each of these staged accidents. The film is also about Johnson helping her father move out of his home and end his psychiatric practice in Seattle so he can live with her in her one-bedroom apartment in New York City. Johnson's mother died from Alzheimer's disease in 2007. Dick Johnson is Dead is the seventh movie Kirsten Johnson's directed. She's also been the cinematographer for over 50 documentaries, including Citizen Four, Pray the Devil Back to Hell, and The Oath. In her 2016 movie, Camera Person, she took spare footage from her decades of work in documentaries and edited them together and called it her memoir. I spoke to Kirsten Johnson on Monday from her home in New York. Here's a clip from Dick Johnson is Dead, where Kirsten and her dad are talking about his memory.
I don't really notice a big problem with my memory. I think it's more apparent to people around me than it is to me.
You do experience worry that you'll be a burden.
Yeah.
What does that mean to you?
Nothing much more than it says. I'm living with you now, and you might get worse. You might have to take care of me more than you do now. But I like living with you, so I'm not terribly worried about it.
Do you have any, there are some people who feel like if it gets worse to a certain place, I don't want to live.
No, I love life too much for that.
So you would be interested in living to the state that mom was in where she couldn't communicate?
Yeah, I think so. But I'll give you permission to euthanize me.
At what point do I have permission to do that?
Well, pass it by me before you do it.
That's a scene. That's a scene from Dick Johnson is Dead. And you hear Dick Johnson there and his daughter, Kirsten Johnson, who is the filmmaker. Kirsten Johnson, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Sam. I'm just laughing because that really is my dad in all of his twists and turns. Yeah.
So how did you come up with the idea of making this movie where you kill off your dad and all these various accidental deaths?
I'm the most easygoing person in the world, and then I'm also like completely oppositional. So I never like to think of ideas as happening in one moment or coming from one place. Mm-hmm. So one of the primary places this came from was the experience we had making my previous film, Camera Person. And this wonderful editor I work with, Nels Bengerder, he placed a shot of my mother alive after a shot of her ashes in a box. And it so startled me. I really had the impression that she came back to life. And it was like, oh, right, cinema can do this. So that was part of the origin story. And then, of course, I had a dream. I'm like a big, vivid dreamer. And I had a dream in which I saw an open casket and a man who wasn't my father sat up and said, I'm Dick Johnson and I'm not dead yet. And that just felt like it just like clicked something in me of like, oh, wait a minute, my time is running out with him.
And then how did you broach the subject with your dad?
Ever since I was, you know, pretty little with my dad, we have kind of amazing conversations about all kinds of things. But we're both really interested in psychology and we're both really into novels and movies and sort of talking about like, how is it that people behave this way or that way? And I often will tell him my dreams. And I told him I had that dream and that it had given me this idea that maybe we could do his funeral before he really died. And also, could that be a movie in which he died and came back to life and we could just keep doing it until he really died? Like we'd have this project together for the rest of his life.
And
he laughed.
Yeah, was he game? He was like, yeah, okay, cool.
He kind of was, honestly. I mean, I would say he is a modest person and like he's right in some ways. He's like, my life's not that interesting. What's going to happen in this movie? And I was like, well, you're going to unexpectedly die, so that'll be interesting. But he was not particularly interested in being the center of things, but he was absolutely interested in doing something with me full time, spending time together, watching movies together, making something funny together.
I have to say, when I watched the movie for the first time, you know, I was home on my computer, as where we watch movies these days, and your dad's walking down the street and an air conditioner falls on his head. And I knew that was going to happen, but it totally took me by surprise. And I jumped out of my seat and I started yelling. Like, I was not prepared for that.
You yelled?
Yeah, I yelled. I was like, yeah. So why did you choose accidental deaths? Like there's a scene where you're talking to a stunt person about like all the various ways he could enact your dad's death. And he sort of is suggesting like a stabbing situation. You're like, well, we're not really trying to do that. We're trying to do these accidents. Like, why was that what you wanted?
Well, accidents happen, right? And there is a way in which there's a part of me that is the part of me from Camera Person where I have like this profound respect for other people's suffering. And, you know, when I think back over the course of my life and the many tragedies of people in the world I have encountered, you know, of terrible accidents happening to them or to their children or to their parents. And, you know, people are just devastated for the rest of their lives because something just, you know, like could have been changed by an inch and it wouldn't have happened, right? And then that sort of creates that desperate, if only I had feeling. And what I initially wanted, I wanted big stunts. I wanted him to catch on fire. You know, I wanted to put him out on an ice floe. I wanted Jackie Chan to help us because I really was interested also in this role of the stunt person because like with Camera Person, there's this sense that there's this invisible world of people who help make things. And so I started thinking about stunt people and death, like that they're literally risking their own lives on behalf of being invisible in a film. And for all of us to take it lightly on a certain level, you know, like, oh, That movie star didn't just die, of course, right? But we're not thinking of the person who had to catch themselves on fire and like fall out of a building. So I did want to do big stunts. But then once we started to do them, it became really clear that my father's dementia was such that it would be really hard to do those stunts. And then suddenly the realization of, this probably is the more likely way that he would die. And honestly, the first stunt we did was at home, me and him just messing around and looking at the staircase where my mother had fallen. And unbelievably, she broke her hip and we didn't know it. She had Alzheimer's. So that same staircase that had taken her down, you know, I was like, Dad, will you like lie down at the bottom of it? And once he did that, like to see my 84-year-old father like laughing, but also just the vulnerability of him laying himself out at the bottom of the stairs because I had asked him to, both made me question the entire idea and also say, wow, this is potent.
You say in the movie that you thought enacting his death would help you prepare for when it really came. Did it work that way? Or was it also like a distraction for you and him, like something to do together?
So one, like, you know, like documentary filmmaking, like death, emotions are so deeply unexpected, right? Our own emotions are so deeply unexpected. And as a parent, I'm always having these moments of just like, why is this enraging me? Like, you know, just it'll just thwack you out of the blue. Like, you're like, I'm so mad at one of my kids because they weren't trying. Why did that matter so much to me, you know? And one of the first huge surprises for me was after we did the funeral, I woke up just so depressed the Monday after we did the funeral. And I realized like some part of me had completely convinced myself if we did the funeral really in the church with my dad's friends, he would never die. Like I really realized, oh, that's what I thought I was doing.
The movie's also about having to move your dad out of his house. This is the home outside of Seattle where you grew up, getting him to shut down his psychiatry business and moving him into your apartment in New York, so all the way across the country. What precipitated that decision?
We eased into knowing my mom's dementia. It took all of us, I would say, a couple of years before we all finally admitted it to ourselves. My father and mother were living together and I was traveling. I was in Sudan and in Liberia, and I would come home and I'd be like, huh, what's this doing in this cupboard? You know, that kind of thing. But mom would really put on a pretty great performance whenever I would, or my brother would come home. And the same thing started to happen with my father, where I'd just be like, huh, that's funny. I thought he mentioned that already. But then his secretary called and she said, you know, Dr. Johnson has double booked a patient again this week and he never does that. And she said the pharmacy called and I think there's an issue with one of the prescriptions. So that was just like very serious news. And then, you know, comes the crazy story of he got off on an exit and somehow arrived home with four flat tires. Well, it turns out he drove through a construction site. And we got one of our neighbors to figure out like where he had been and what had happened. But it was a little bit of detective work. And then he sort of laughed it off. And it was just like an odd story you couldn't quite vet, you know? And there started to be more and more things like that until suddenly it was just like, oh, this is happening. But we did get a friend and his son were looking for a place to live for a while. So they moved into the house with Dad for a couple of months and they totally verified, yeah, things are not right.
There's a scene I like to play. I think this happens in a lot of families where someone has gotten too old to drive. And clearly in your dad's case, like he, you know, as you said, he got home with four flat tires, like fortunately didn't hurt anyone. But this is the kind of the confrontation where he's realizing that he's no longer going to be able to drive. And that's really tough for some people to take. So let's just hear that clip.
You never said you were taking the car away from me.
It was said that we were selling the car because you're moving to New York.
Yeah, I always said that.
Right, that's all.
But who's selling and when and where?
It's being put on Craigslist this week. It's at the repair shop being finished right now.
I'm telling you what I know. But you're not getting the car back. I do know that.
Never driving it again.
No, not that car. Maybe some other car. Is that the worst news ever?
Not the worst, but it's pretty bad news.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not far enough gone that I couldn't drive my own car. You know?
Well, it's not about that. It's about the fact that you're moving to New York.
Yeah, I know.
You can't keep the car.
I'm not taking my car.
That's right. That's all.
But in between now and the time...
It's only a couple of days.
Okay.
Sorry. I know it hurts. It's your independence, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I know how Mom must have felt when we put her in a nursing home.
Is that what it feels like?
Not that bad.
It's not that bad.
Not that bad.
It's not that bad.
It's not that bad, but that was bad.
You're a little more conscious than she was then.
Yeah, but not giving you credit for much more consciousness.
Yes, we are. Stop it. We're just not paying $2,000 to put a car in a rental car garage in New York City, that's all.
That's all, yeah.
That's all we're doing.
I hear
you. You hear me?
Yeah.
That's a scene from Dick Johnson is Dead, and filmmaker Kirsten Johnson is our guest. Kirsten, that's, you know, that scene really teared me up when I watched it. And the thing that the listener is not seeing is your dad is literally putting a good face to this situation. Like, he keeps kind of smiling. He's really trying to, you know, accept the situation, but it's really hard for him. And I love what you're doing there. Like, you're really trying to soften the blow. You know, you're like, well, we're just not going to pay for the car. Like, we're moving to New York. You don't use cars in New
right.
York, you know, like, and you do that a lot. It's just a really sweet way to handle this really hard situation, I think.
One of the people working on the film was saying to me, you're sure you're not from the Midwest, you two? Like, you're just always trying to make each other feel better about all this. And that is certainly true. You know, I mean, I think because we went through it with my mom, we both know what's coming. So it's so brutal what's coming that we both, I think, would be like, we're not there yet. It's not that bad, you know? And of course, I'm like trying all these tactics. Like, my dad, you know, notoriously does not want to spend large amounts of money for things. So I was just like, it's $2,000 to have a parking garage in New York. You know, like, he's like, oh, in that case, we don't want the car there, you know? So I do try all kinds of tactics. And yet, you know, I have a dear friend, Carol Deisinger, whose mother had dementia. And she said to me, when my mom started to get it, she said, you know, some of these decisions you make too early or you make them too late. And that's how she got me to take my mom's driver's license away from her. Because I was like, oh, right, my mom could run someone over. But then my mother never forgave us for taking away the driver's license. She was so mad about that all the way, like, after she'd forgotten everything, she was still mad about that. So I was really scared to get my dad to stop driving. I didn't know how I was going to do it.
So do you see, like, an erasure of your dad's personality? Or do you see it like as a crystallization of him? Like, how do you come to understand what this illness is doing to him?
It's doing so many things to him. I mean, he is distilled to his essence, which I would say, you know, he can call me multiple times in a day and simply say to me, I'm just checking to see if you know that I love you. And, you know, that is who he has been my entire life, right? Just affirming that. All of these words are applicable. I do think the loss of his capacity to have an extended conversation, an analytic conversation, it's a profound loss for him and for me. I mean, my biggest conundrums, the most challenging problems for me, I could go to my dad and just say, like, I want to lay this out for you. And I don't understand why I'm behaving in this way. I don't understand what's happening. And he could just, like, break it apart and ask questions. Never, never judge, never give me even advice. Just ask questions that then allowed me to think, oh, okay, I see what's going on here. And so that I have definitely lost, and he has definitely lost. But every once in a while, I can still like come in with like a question, and he'll just go deep analytic and be right in there for the length of that question so I can get it, you know. So in some ways, it's taught me new ways to think and talk and interact with him.
Well, Kirsten Johnson, thanks so much for being on Fresh Air.
Oh, Sam, this has been such a pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Kirsten Johnson's newest film is called Dick Johnson is Dead. It's now streaming on Netflix. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, and Kayla Lattimore. Our associate producer of digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.